The name of our podcast, Tech Sequences, is really a mashup of two words, technology and consequences. We are fascinated by the consequences, intended or unintended, of the internet and related technologies for the way we live, play, and work. We are your hosts, Leslie Daigle and Alexa Rod. We started our careers at the dawn of the internet and have been friends, colleagues, and comrades in arms for the better part of 20 years. In this podcast, we examine the impact internet-related technologies have made or may make in our lives. I'm Alexa Rod.
And I'm Leslie Daigle.
And today's episode is about artificial intelligence and its impacts on what it means to be human. Today's guest is Lee Rainey. Lee Rainey is the Director of Internet and Technology Research at Pew Research Center. Under his leadership, the center has issued more than 650 reports based on its surveys that examine people's online activities and the internet's role in their lives. The American Sociological Association gave Rainey its award for excellence in the reporting on social issues in 2014 and described his work as the most authoritative source of reliable data on the use and impact of the internet and mobile connectivity. Rainey is a co-author of Networks, the New Social Operating System, and five books about the future of the internet that are drawn from the center's research. Prior to launching Pew Research Center's technology research, Rainey was managing author of U.S. News and World Report. He's a graduate of Harvard University and has a master's degree in political science from Long Island University. Welcome, Rainey.
Hi, Alexa and Leslie. It's great to be with you.
Great. Thanks. It's really looking forward to this discussion. So tell us just a little bit about Pew Research and the kind of research you do.
The Pew Research Center self-describes as a fact tank because we think we're in a different line of work from think tanks. In think tanks, policy analysts look at problems, come up with ideas about how to solve them, and aggressively promote those ideas. We are not in that line of work. We do a lot of social science research, and we do it to try to bring data to big cultural conversations and policy conversations, but we do it without any agenda driving our work. I oversee the internet and technology research at the center, but we're not cheerleaders for the internet. We don't have policy positions we like about privacy and net neutrality and misinformation and things like that, but we hope we do research that is useful to the policy community. And in this particular case, in addition to doing big public opinion surveys that are meant to represent whole populations of entire nations, this research is a little bit more focused on what experts think about the future and how they see the future unfolding. So it's not a real scientific survey, but we get a lot of people to answer questions about the future, and I'm excited to talk about it.
Great. And this research is in December 2018, you published the piece of work called Artificial Intelligence and the Future of Humans. And the question you sought to answer was, AI continues to half the world population, will people be better off? So there's no implicit assumption that AI automatically improves our lives. And I think you've touched on that a little bit just now in saying that you don't do this as a biased report, but talk a little bit about what you maybe expected or what you saw in the report in terms of that assumption.
Our center has been in existence for 20 years, and we've watched the rise of a variety of technologies and documented how broadband became a thing in the culture and how mobile phones, particularly smartphones, changed the way that people interact with each other, share information, create information and things. And the way social media joined with those mobile interactions have changed lots of the information ecosystem. So the next revolution that's clearly on the horizon is the artificial intelligence revolution. And we're just now thinking about a research agenda where we could be talking to the general public about the role of artificial intelligence. But we knew first we had to learn from folks who are in the building process and in thinking about this and are examining the cultural implications of this, because it's this stage of the process where big decisions are being made about the ethics that might be applied to these systems, about the way that they will roll out in both business contexts and government contexts and nonprofit contexts. And so our aspiration in this work was to begin to think what our own research agenda should be, but also to talk about what's on people's minds as this next revolution in technology unfolds.
Right. So as part of the research, you talked to several hundred experts in AI, as you mentioned, that you were seeking the big brains in this area. Do you want to say anything about how they were chosen and sort of what background they had?
Sure. When we began to do this work looking into the future, we started it in the year 2005. So this was actually the 10th version of surveys that we've conducted over the years about things that were unfolding in the future. And we began in 2005 with a database of about 5,000 experts who were well-documented commentators, pundits, analysts, and technologists themselves. And we started by asking them questions about what might be happening by the year 2020 or 2022. As over time, we've built that database up to over 12,000 people. It grows. You two were added to the list because your friends said that you were smart technology analysts, and we've been happy to have your contributions to our more recent surveys. And it's sort of a rolling sample. Partly it's gathered by watching who presents at conferences, watching who publishes in interesting journals, as well as popular press outlets, who is actually in the field. So we go to a lot of technology conferences and things like that. So we gather up lists of people who are, you know, building the stuff. And then we get a lot of academics responding to these surveys, and they come from all different kinds of disciplines. They're in communication scholarship, they're in political science scholarship. A bunch of them are related to the medical profession, health informatics, and things like that. So it's been a sort of grab bag of ways that we've invited people into our surveys. And we close our surveys by saying, who else should be asked to respond to a question like this? And I'm pretty sure that's the way we got your names into our survey. So it's not a very scientific and very structured process of bringing people in. We want a lot of people to comment on these things, and have found over the years that the diversity of perspectives is a really interesting thing. If we were only talking to AI, computer scientists, we'd be getting a lot of interesting perspectives, but that would not be the same as everybody else. So in a way, the diversity and just sort of haphazard, fun way we've assembled
organic
the database is interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, no, and I mean, it while it's true that computer scientists may build the AI, all of us have to live with it. So it's valuable to get the different perspectives.
Exactly.
Speaking of, it's interesting you talked about perspectives and the amount of people that you, all the different experts you went to. If you look at the ones that are in the news, like Elon Musk, right? In 2014, he called, at MIT, he called AI humanity's single biggest threat and compared it to summoning a demon. You have about 4,000 Google employees starting in 2018 who signed a petition asking Google to get out of this contract, $9 million contract with the Pentagon. And Stephen Hawking, prior to his death in 2014, he told BBC that development of full artificial intelligence could spell the end of the human race. All of these experts, at least what's in the news, is really pointing to this doomsday landscape of autonomous weapons and so forth. However, in your findings, you found human agency as the top concern. Can you talk about that?
Sure. Well, if you looked at the concerns that Elon Musk, Stephen Hawking, and Bill Gates is among those who are worried about the trajectory of things, the main concern they had was about a set of tools that might supplant human beings as the preeminent intelligent agents in our world. And what were the runaway possibilities of it? In other words, if you're a
Skynet
fan of Westworld, you might be wondering about that after the season-ending episode just a couple of days ago. So human agency was on our minds in part because that's the end game. When people talk about the singularity, that intelligent machines might surpass human intelligence in the foreseeable future, the sort of main thing, the existential thing that they think about is what becomes of humans in a world where we're not the most brilliant, the smartest, the most conscious agents, that there are other things in the world that take over. So in a way, human agency subsumes all the other concerns that people are raising when they bring this up. So among other things, in this particular survey, an easy thing for lots of commentators to talk about was about the black box dimensions of AI. That the way that algorithms are structured, the way that machine learning is taking place, it's easy enough to see now that decisions will be made and learnings will take place that are not necessarily understandable in the context of even the creators of these machines, and not necessarily explainable once they start making decisions about how to organize the world or how to make sense of the data that they're being fed. So there's a sense that we're handing off to machines now the capacity to make our own decisions. Sometimes just the assemblage of that data and the learnings that take place in that, there are plenty of benefits that can come from that. There are smarter systems. There are better ways to organize our economy. There's better ways to organize our medicine and our education. So they can easily talk about the steps along the way where improvements in the human condition are pretty clear and certainly identifiable from the way things are going. It's that sort of beyond the horizon concern that they've got, that these things by increments get better and better and better. But at some point, the increments add up to something that's much bigger than us. And that's the end game that is so worrisome to the pundits you were quoting.
And it seems like a lot of their concern was really about artificial general intelligence and artificial super intelligence, not the ones that we currently know, the artificial narrow intelligence like Alexa or the Google Assistant, which are really narrowly focused on doing a particular job, you know, the personal assistants and so forth, or the translation. Google Translate is another example. What I found was really interesting, I think Judith Donath, one of the experts you talked to from Harvard's Berkman Center, she actually talked about this future in 2030. By the way, we should mention that your arc of how far they should be looking at was really just 2030. It's not that far into the future. What she mentioned was a future where we are interacting with bots, robots, and we don't even know that they are robots. In other words, we're interacting emotionally with them and considering them almost as on par emotionally. When you said Westworld, it sort of reminded me of that, except in Westworld, they are emotional and the humans treat them as if they are not. And that's the big drama of the series.
Exactly. What Judith, who's one of our most faithful and really brilliant contributors over the years, she put it this way: via screen and projection, the voice, appearance, and behaviors of bots will be indistinguishable from those of humans. And even physical robots, though obviously non-human, will be so convincingly sincere that our impression of them as thinking, feeling beings on par or with superior to ourselves will be unshaken. Again, she, like others, isn't necessarily sure that 2030 is the moment that this might happen. But if you look at the trajectory of the improvements that are being made in these systems now, it's certainly reasonable to think that this will happen in the foreseeable future.
Right. And I think there was a report by Imperva, which is a bot detection agency, just in 2019. And they talked about the fact that 25% of all the traffic on the internet are generated by malicious robots. Now there are, by malicious bots. There are bots that are not necessarily malicious, such as those that go and index search engines and so forth, but already 25% of the internet traffic is not generated by humans. And I think she's somewhat on the same, she's right about that trajectory.
Well, yeah, I would actually take that a slightly different direction, though. I mean, I think it all rolls up to the same problem, which is when you have computing devices that are, if not self-directing, at least self-compounding, and bots that are bots on the internet carrying out internet attacks that are, you know, effectively code that is designed to reach as many systems as possible and carry out bad actions. It's hard to analyze them. It's hard to peer inside and understand what the overall system of somebody else's code or the collection of bots is doing. And I think that fundamentally is at the basis of our fear of, you know, AI, whether they're, you know, physically resembling human robots, or even, you know, images or like you say, Alexa and Google systems. We can't understand how they arrive at a particular choice. We have to trust that they arrived at it based on some set of principles that we can't confirm.
Right.
What, one of the things that we see in our very current work on the misinformation, disinformation, made up information front, is we've looked at Twitter streams and found that in tweets that contain links, so they're referring people to another place and presumably a validated place, 2/3 of the tweets with links in them to news sites are bot generated on Twitter.
Wow.
The adult sites is even higher. And some community-based activities are lower. But the fact of the matter, as you're saying, Leslie, is this is a part of life now, and it is already confusing people. It's already faking out people in the mistaken impression that these are real humans saying real things that deserve real attention. And so this is exactly the compounding problem that some of the fearful are warning against.
Lee, talk about some of the other concerns that people raised. You know, human agency was number one. Data abuse was number two. And then job loss, interestingly enough, was number three. You would think instinctively that perhaps job loss would be ahead of data abuse, but in fact, these experts put data abuse first. So what do they mean by data abuse?
Well, the way that we framed this question was very broad and very generic. And so in a way, we weren't scoring people's answers by tonnage, how many people said human agency and how many people said job loss. We basically said by 2030, are people going to be better off thanks to AI or worse off? And about 2/3 said better off, but almost everybody who even said that, in other words, they're convinced that the future of AI, at least in the medium term, will be a decent future. Almost all of them could cite problems that they know are embedded in these structures. So when we get down to job loss, it was just one of the things that was a recurring theme throughout answers, even of the most positive folks who were saying it's clear that AI not only jeopardizes repetitive working class jobs like those on the factory floor, you know, robots are replacing line workers in factories, but now they're moving pretty convincingly into jobs that heretofore were paid jobs that required human intelligence. You know, insurance adjusters apply some human decision-making to how they're going to set prices and how they're going to handle claims and things like that. Radiologists who are looking at the results of x-rays and other scans are doing the same thing. Well, now that kind of stuff is being outsourced or moved over to AI systems that in many cases do as good or better job at the task at hand than the human beings do. So when people were talking about job loss here, they were not only talking about sort of current jobs that are in jeopardy, but they were talking about this sort of creeping capacity of AI to take over even some human functions of require critical intelligence and pattern recognition and convincing complicated communications and things like that. So the sort of end game dread here is that a large, large swaths of the human population are going to be really irrelevant to the workforce.
Yeah, and what I found was interesting, you mentioned radiologists, and that's exactly the example I was thinking about, that the kinds of job losses are not just going to be in the very low income sections, but also in some of the higher income, higher prestige areas. But it seemed overall, those that actually mentioned, those that you categorized around the job loss, were also talking about that AI would really compound this divide between the haves and the have-nots.
Exactly. There's just a pervasive concern, even among the most enthusiastic, optimistic experts, that the processes that unfold here, particularly economically and with jobs, will make worse the divides that already exist in our cultures, that people who don't have relatively high levels of education, the people who aren't motivated necessarily to keep evaluating their skills and keep upgrading the things that they are capable of doing, they're going to get hammered in this universe. And it's not clear that there are public policies or education programs or things like that that are going to pull them out of the difficulties.
So how much is that really going to be a problem sort of for a generation, or how much is going to be a problem for the human race? So, I mean, is this a case of a portrait painter being put out of work by a photographer, but, you know, future generations of photographers will do just well, thank you. Or is this a case where, you know, we're simply taking away the whole area and profession of capturing images?
Yeah. We asked that question a couple of years ago and got an absolutely divided verdict. Half the experts said eventually more jobs will be created that will take up the slack of the jobs that are lost. And half said this is a wholly different set of circumstances from the industrial era changes that occurred that did displace buggy whip makers and elevator operators and telephone operators and things like that, that the challenge to human capacity is so pervasive and coming from so many different angles that our systems won't be able to cope with it, and we won't be able necessarily to invent new things like the apps culture. I mean, 15 years ago when we began this work, there was not a very high employment sector of apps builders. Now there is. So these changes do involve some interesting transitions and things, but people are not certain. I mean, the negative argument is we've never seen anything like this in history. There are just too many ways it's pressing in on us, and we won't be able to, you know, find our way out of it. The positive people sort of say history always teaches us that when new technologies come into being, sure, jobs are lost. Actually, the net number of new jobs never replaces the net number of jobs lost. What ends up being a boon to the economy is that things get so much cheaper and so much more available to people that they spend more money on them, or they spend, you know, a lot more people can afford them. And so the desire and demand for apps, the desire and demand for new kinds of art and culture, the desire and demand for new kinds of human caregiving that might be enabled by this will eventually come into being, because there are now markets for them and there are tools to do them. And that's how you get progress that ends up being good for everybody. So it's sort of a mixed bag, and Pew doesn't have an answer to how it's going to end up.
Yeah, no, that's pretty clear. But even as we're talking, it seems to me that there's sort of a divide between concerns about, you know, the black box nature of AI as discussed previously, and the inability to either detect it or, you know, in some cases debug it, because there's always the concern that you know, a black box system will consistently give a wrong answer or a poor answer, and you'll be unable to fix that. You know, as an example, an AI reviewing CVs is going to pick CVs that match ones like it already knows, as opposed to considering, you know, less well known candidates. So a distinction
between exactly to the data abuse problem that Alexa was asking about. And just quickly, what people were talking about there is exactly this, that these AI systems depend on humans to write them at the moment. And humans come with a whole bunch of biases, even if they're well-intentioned. And it comes with exploitation or use of data that also might have biases already in it. And so, and when you mix that up in a stew and put it in the hands of people whose most important imperative is to make money, you've got problems or the potential for lots of problems. And so that's what people are talking about when they worry about the coders and the material that's being coded itself.
Right. And it doesn't have to be malicious. I mean, one of my favorite examples is from the Second World War, not involving computing AI, but involving training dogs. I recall the story of, you know, the Russians were training dogs to carry mines and run under, you know, Allied tanks and blow them up. Right. And, And so they tested and tested and trained and trained, and it was all good. And then they went into the field with it and was still all good, except that they recognized Russian tanks, only Russian tanks. Mm-hmm. So it goes to the point of you don't really know what features are being the key ones in training. And so it's hard to, it's a black box. Yeah. But that's one sort of one set of concerns is the whole notion of how does one do AI well, given that it ultimately becomes a black box. And then there's a separate question of all the fears and concerns that transpire for letting go of a certain amount of control and the impact on society. And there seems to be a bit of a sort of a dividing line, if you will, between those sets of concerns.
Well, one of the things these experts talk about is the moment when a lot of us begin to have smart agents acting in our behalf. I mean, think of the enormously the big conveniences that will come from, you know, potentially you getting the exact information you want when you need it on the subject that matters to you, and having your, you know, Leslie doppelganger go out and find it for you without you having to expend a lot of time and effort to figure it out and sort it and find it and stuff like that. It's the mission creep and the convenience creep and also the benefits creep that people will experience in this stuff is going to be pretty compelling. It's going to help a lot of people in a lot of ways that they can specifically identify. You know, they will know how much time they save. They will know how much better the diagnosis was. They will be able to articulate pretty clearly why they hated doing that routine drudge work, repetitive, stupid thing that they now have outsourced to a bot. So this is the dynamic that unfolds here. And there are good things that will come from AI that people will be able to identify and appreciate.
Let's talk about some of those good things. I think in the responses that you got from experts, they were categorized as what kind of areas, for example, AI could really help. One was healthcare and the study of genome and DNA. What were some of the other areas where people were pretty optimistic about the impact of AI for, you know, ultimately our lives?
The other big area that they talked a lot about, in addition to the workplace stuff that we've already covered, but the healthcare was clearly one where customized, directed kinds of treatment and evidence gathering will have a payoff at both the individual level and at the population level. I mean, think now about what might be happening as we think about location monitoring that's anonymized, but we can tell where hotspots from the COVID-19 virus are breaking out. The third area that people talked about great benefits was education. And it essentially is the same dynamic that they talk about when they talk about medicine. Education can be much more customized now and not necessarily sort of a mass product. If you figure out what someone knows and what they need to know next, and it's different from the kid or the person who's sitting next to them at the desk or on the Zoom screen or whatever, you can make a lot more progress by helping that person in that way as distinct from helping another person in another way because they have a different learning style or they're at a different point on the mastery spectrum or whatever. And so one of the frustrating things that experts have talked about over the years that we've done these surveys is technology has been a wonderful thing in so many areas, but it has just not been applied very deeply in education. And why? Yeah. It just is like a perfectly customized, and the early inventors of the internet thought that education was going to be the first big monster payoff. And in many respects, it's been a pretty strong failure.
Until this year.
Not adopted.
Like a pandemic.
Now people sort of say in the AI universe, you'll be able to get that customized learning. You'll be able to get those customized evaluation. You'll be able to get the customized credential. You know, right. You don't necessarily need to go to 4 years of college to learn the basics of AI, you know, and computer science. And so the whole sort of organizing mechanism of formal education might get improved or certainly undone by the things that are developing here in AI.
Yeah, and I mean, I made the comment flippantly, but it's probably quite true that, you know, it takes a pandemic to make people realize the value of the internet in terms of delivering education and, or at least educational bits. And I'm not suggesting that everybody who suddenly deployed an online learning system for their school has got it right, but it's potentially a really prime opportunity to be exploring some of that. And to further your point about, you know, it was a long time ago that experts started playing with AI for education. My master's thesis is actually about AI in education. So, and that was a long, time ago.
Well, now you can just say you're entering yes. the golden age of your education.
That's okay. Right. So on the flip side, what are the areas where the experts felt AI was going to make things worse or exacerbate existing problems? We talked about one, which was the gap between the rich and the poor. What about, you know, democracy, for example, the impact of democracy? We kind of touched on that. And the surveillance state.
That was the tweets discussion, right?
Yeah.
Well, I do worry about the impact on democracy, particularly to the degree that the sort of information systems that undergird, that they're the substructure of democracy, are now so challenged. I mean, you know, the flow of information and the way people learn about each other and the way they learn about their communities and the way they learn about their governing structures is now got a whole bunch of gum in the works. And the people who would cause mischief for democratic institutions only have to confuse people. They don't have to convince people to change their minds or to, you know, hate capitalism or whatever. All they have to do is confuse people enough so that they give up trying to think that being a citizen matters and things. So that's right. A lot what's on people's minds. The other part of this, again, we sort of flicked at it, but they think that in this loss of potential loss of human agency, that we're going to hand off literally killing machines and killing decisions to algorithms and to autonomous policing and autonomous battlefield systems and autonomous weapon systems. They're really freaked out about that. I mean, you know, the Skynet scenario came up in a whole bunch of answers.
Right. So now to flip side, some of the suggestions that they talked about, the top suggestion seemed to be thinking of the common good, the public good, and trying to work together to come up with constructs. And to me, in some ways, it sounds like that's a wonderful ideal, but could it also be somewhat Pollyanna? In other words, given the fact that we have not only all these companies that are now engaged in AI and their whole revenue stream is based on AI or will be based on AI, are they going to really want to work with one another, cooperate with one another in such a way to help allay some of these fears? It sounds great, but from a tactical perspective, a realistic perspective, will that happen?
Well, one of the really brilliant analysts in this field, Eric Brynjolfsson from MIT, who's written a lot about these subjects, was one of the respondents in this survey. And he framed the choice that you are articulating here is not so much what will happen. I mean, there are certain ways in which AI will unfold, but it's the decisions that we can be making right now about what we will allow to happen, what we choose to do. And so starting with the sense that humans should be at the center of all this decision-making does sound like an elemental, almost simple-minded way to be thinking about it. But so many of these experts who are deep, deep, deep into these systems and deep into understanding them also say the same thing, that if you know, when you're sitting down to do this stuff, if you don't put humans at the top of the equation, you potentially end up with humans at the bottom of the equation. And so putting people first is sort of rule one that they would have any AI builder apply to the structure. And it's not making profits, and it's not necessarily even making like a supply chain more efficient or a medical diagnosis more efficient. If the end game of this seems to turn over too much control to the black box, to the robots, these folks would sort of say, slow down and think about it and make sure that in the end of it all, humans can still flip the off switch if they need to, or certainly can sort of decide when the machines have aggregated too much decision-making and too much power.
Yeah, that's because everybody working on it now grew up with Isaac Asimov's iRobot and know the three laws of robotics and extensions thereof.
Well, it's so interesting now, and there are really a lot of interesting convenings around the ethics of AI. And, you know, there are refinements of those four laws that are pretty nice.
We should actually talk about those, just briefly mention those four laws, because folks don't necessarily know what they are.
Well, I'm going to outsource that to you.
All right, Leslie, you want to do it?
Yeah, well, so the three laws of Asimov's three laws of robotics were: a robot may not injure a human being or, through inaction, allow a human being to come to harm. That's number one. Number two, a robot must obey the orders given it by human beings, except where such orders would conflict with the first law. And three, a robot must protect its own existence as long as such protection does not conflict with the first or the second law. And then the added fourth law states a robot must reproduce as long as such reproduction does not interfere with the first or second or third law. And then the fifth added law of the three laws of robotics says a robot must know it is a robot.
There you go.
All right. So Lee, are there any sort of last comments you want to make? Are there anything that surprised you or that jumped out at you in the research that you did and some of the comments that the experts said?
The one dimension of our findings that I only flicked at a little bit before, that but it was truly the surprising, unexpected insight that we got from these experts related to one of the problems people saw that ties to autonomy, human autonomy, which was a warning about what they called dependence lock-in. So one of the compelling things that people talk about, the pro-human things that people talk about in AI, is it will enhance some of the nicest parts about being human, enhance our brain power and our memory and our physical abilities and even our longevity and things like that. But there comes a point that some of these experts warned where we essentially outsource our decision-making and our capacity to influence the world to the machines, because it's easy, because it's convenient, because why not? The machines have served us so well before. And the long-term concern that they have is that as we get potentially more dependent on this stuff, we get lazy and we don't work as hard as we probably should at human relations, at community building, at all of the wonderful dimensions of life that make human beings wonderful and special.
So to sum it up, would you say that overall, these 979 experts, were they cautiously optimistic, cautiously pessimistic, or cautiously realistic?
For the medium term, we were asking for the 10 or 11 years out from when we were asking the question, they are cautiously optimistic. They can articulate pretty clearly the things that will happen that will be beneficial to humans, starting with saving lives. And the caveat that a lot of even the optimistic people sounded is in that those short-term benefits potentially add up to long-term catastrophe, because the machines get better and better and better. We get more and more and more dependent. The power of the machines to make decisions that are not understandable or not even explainable grows over time. And so they're long-term, somewhat cautiously downcast.
So if I were to sort of reflect on the last 5 minutes of conversation, my takeaway might be is something along the lines of, this is actually not only a call to make sure that AI progresses carefully with, you know, appropriate focus on supporting humans, but also that we humans go forward and focus on being humans and, you know, make sure that we don't get lazy, that we don't think that this is an opportunity to abdicate our responsibilities, you know, civic responsibilities and interpersonal responsibilities and you know, responsibilities to self, to be all that we can be.
And to one another and to the community. Yep. Well, Lee, this has been really wonderful. And thank you so much for giving us the time and going Indeed. Through this research with us. Really appreciate it. Hope to have you again next time.
Thank you so much. It was really fun.
Great. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to this TechSequences podcast. We are Leslie Daigle and Alexa Rod. You can reach us by email, techsequences@techsequences.org. We'd love to hear from you to know what you thought about this episode or ideas for future episodes. TechSequences. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook and subscribe through your favorite podcasting service.